Thanks to Ray Cruz and Pledge Central. Aloha and welcome to The Conversation. I'm Chris Vandercook. The city of Raqqa is a nerve center for the Islamic State and a nightmare for its residents. News of the suffering there has emerged largely through social media and the world of citizen journalists. Their story is told in the documentary City of Ghosts. And Hana Maui is becoming the victim of its own reputation as one of Hawaii's most beautiful destinations. We'll talk to a local resident about efforts to control the runaway flow of traffic in and out. And poet Edward Hirsch comes to Hawaii as part of a tribute to Maui's W.S. Merwin. It's September 27th, day one of our fall pledge drive. Those conversations and a few more right after this news. Journalism has rarely been as dangerous as it is in today's Syria, where years of civil war have torn the country to pieces. Since 2011, hundreds of journalists, many of them non-professional, so-called citizen journalists, have been killed in Syria, having risked their lives to tell the story of the horror they witness every day. A group of them, calling Raqqa as being slaughtered silently, was given the International Press Freedom Award in 2015 and the 2016 Civil Courage Prize for its efforts to document human rights abuses in that city. Their story is told in the documentary City of Ghosts, which will be screened tomorrow evening at the Honolulu Museum of Art. Nandita Sharma is an associate professor of racism, migration, and transnationalism in the Department of Sociology at the University of Hawaii at Manoa and a member of Hawaii J20, the group sponsoring the screening. She's with us in our studio. Hi, Nandita. Thanks for coming in.
Happy to be here.
What's the situation in the city of Raqqa today?
Well, it goes from worse to worse. You know, Raqqa has been under siege since at least 2013 by bombardments by the Syrian regime, followed by the occupation of Raqqa by ISIS, which declared it its headquarters for its caliphate. And then subsequently, as that is all continuing, the U.S., in the name of fighting terrorism, has bombarded it as well. And this organization that is featured in the film, Raqqa is Being Slaughtered Silently, has documented widespread civilian deaths as a result of U.S. strikes.
Documented how?
It's very interesting because they have worked in a situation of absolute secrecy.
Yeah.
ISIS actually, when they occupied the city, declared that it was illegal to transmit images and news via the internet.
Mm-hmm.
They shut down cell phone access to the population, to the civilian population in Raqqa. So this organization had to figure out how to get satellite-operated phones with, you know, gasoline-powered generators. And surreptitiously, you know, while they're riding around on their motorbikes, walking down the street, with their cell phones, you know, very basic technology, try and upload that and get that out to the world's media.
The equipment, part of it is small, mobile, easy to conceal equipment, but not that easy. If you get caught with any of these pieces of equipment, you're going to get killed, right?
Absolutely. And at least 14 members of Raqqa is Being Slaughtered Silently have already been murdered by ISIS.
And yet their efforts continue. What kind of mechanisms do they use? And has the, you know, the fact that they've become a celebrated international organization, has that drawn fire to them within the city?
Absolutely. I mean, they're under fire by ISIS. They're under fire by Assad's regime because they also are opponents of that regime.
Yeah.
And they are, you know, faithfully documenting the U.S. airstrikes. So they seem to have absolutely no friends in terms of who has power in Raqqa right now. So they are absolutely reliant on anonymity. They don't put their names on their reports.
Mm-hmm.
They report through the name of the organization. And they rely on other media around the world to pick it up and share it. I mean, they do have a website, which, you know, fortunately, we are now in a time where websites are a source of news for a lot of people. But they also have been able to feed other media who, frankly, are not in Raqqa because it is far too dangerous.
The days when mainstream media had correspondents on the ground all over the world are pretty much gone, and there's a lot of reliance on on local sources, just anywhere.
Yeah, and the world is not a better place for that.
No, it's most assuredly not. Do you know the New York Times writers? Do they pick up on what they get from Raqqa's being slaughtered silently?
Yeah, they do. You know, the problem, of course, with reputable news outlets is they do need to verify the news. So in a situation like Raqqa, that becomes very, very difficult. Mm-hmm. But they have been able to manage to do that in some ways, which is remarkable to me.
Has there been much in the way of first-person testimony by the citizen journalists as to what it's like to be doing this?
They have been able to do that once they've left Raqqa. You know, 14 members have already been killed.
Right.
The rest of them live in fear of their lives. Some of them have become refugees. One of the founders of Raqqa is being slaughtered silently, lives here in the United States, was able to enter the U.S. before Trump's Muslim ban, mm-hmm. So was able to get refugee status here. Others live in European states where they've been able to gain asylum. And at that point, they're able to talk. But even still, ISIS has followed them to Germany, to the United States. They get death threats. They get, you know, emails with photos of their apartment doors, their faces, wow. themselves entering their apartments, mm-hmm. saying, "We know where you live." You know, so this is incredibly. This is probably the most dangerous reporting in the world right now.
It certainly sounds it, and yet the world has no shortage of places where it is a risk of your life to become an international journalist.
Absolutely.
In your work at your age, in what you teach, you tell students about the refugee crises around the world. Prior to your telling them about it, do they know much about it?
Well, unfortunately, Syria has been a major victim of what we now call fake news. Mm-hmm. And it's coming from all sides. It's coming from the Syrian regime, which labels any opposition to it as a terrorist. Anyone opposing Assad is labeled a terrorist by the Assad regime. And unfortunately, that gets picked up by others. You know, here in Hawaii, we have Congressperson Tulsi Gabbard, who has essentially said the same thing, that Assad must stay in power because everyone else is a terrorist. That gets picked up by people like Donald Trump, who says, well, we can't let Syrians into the United States because they're all terrorists. So we're in a situation right now where we have a complete and total ban on people entering from Syria into the United States precisely at the moment when Syria is the world's number one refugee-producing state, which is unbelievable to me that we cannot see that people fleeing terror need asylum and they need our help, and instead we've just labeled them terrorists. And I think that is a direct result of fake news.
Well, I wonder, you know, just thinking about the number of displaced persons around the world, we hear about the Rohingya in Myanmar, 400,000 have fled across the border. I mean, how many refugee crises are there in the world today?
The
Congo, right?
It's the worst since World War II. You know, it is absolutely the numbers of people fleeing for their lives is as bad as the people that were fleeing the enormous violence of World War II.
When virtually every continent of the world was embroiled in conflict.
That's right.
That really does put it in perspective, you know.
Yeah, this is not the moment to shut the doors to refugees.
Well, at the same time, you know, going back to what you said about fake news, this is hardly the first time that, you know, the Second World War was full of propaganda.
Right.
On all sides. And that's not that different from fake news, right?
Absolutely.
Why is it so much worse today? What has changed?
I think what has changed is that the places that the fake news is coming from presents itself in ways that reflect your own the personal beliefs that you already hold. Mm-hmm. So, for instance, I've seen even anti-war activists in Hawaii say that Assad, who is a dictator must stay in power. And that is shocking to me. And where those people are getting their news is largely from Russian news sites. Russia has a major stake in Syria. Mm-hmm. They are major backers of the Assad regime. And they say that Assad is legitimate and must be kept in there. And it's American imperialism that wants him out. So then you have people who want to hear that go, well, that's the real news, instead of actually figuring out what's going on. And what is left out of that are the actual voices of people in Syria.
If you want to hear it, you're going to believe it. That's the thing that drives fake news.
Right.
Nandita, we have to go, but thank you very much for coming in. I really appreciate you taking the time.
Thank you, and we hope to see you at the film.
Nandita Sharma is an associate professor of sociology at UH Manoa, member of Hawaii J20, the group sponsoring the screening of the film City of Ghosts, a documentary that follows the journey of Raqqa is being slaughtered silently, a group of citizen journalists who banded together after Raqqa, Syria, was taken over by ISIS in 2014. It will be screened for a week starting tomorrow evening at the Honolulu Museum of Art's Doris Duke Theater.
Support for today's programming comes from Maui Arts and Cultural Center, presenting Shank's Mare, a performance combining Japanese traditional puppetry and live video projection, 7:30 p.m. this Friday at Castle Theater, mauiarts.org.
People who live in Hana, Maui are likely to tell you they wouldn't want to live anywhere else. But life in a remote and beautiful place has its challenges, and as more and more visitors discover the pleasures of a little town with no golf courses or large resort hotels and plenty of natural beauty, those challenges multiply. As anyone who's been there will tell you, the trip in and out of town is an adventure in itself, and deteriorating road conditions on the two roads in and out have caused community members to band together to lobby for improvements to some treacherous stretches of highway. Hana resident Napua Hueo is one of them. She joins us by phone. Hi, Napua. Thanks for talking with us.
Aloha, Chris. Thank you for having me.
Have you lived in Hana most of your life?
Yes, all of my life in the small town of Ke'anai, which is at the halfway point to Hana.
Uh-huh. So you see the traffic up and down the road. What's it like?
Yes, definitely have noticed the traffic from when I was a young girl until now, and seen the growth in numbers as far as visitors who venture the Hana Highway. Mm-hmm. And at this point, we would consider to be over capacity. We have limited parking, numerous issues with illegal parking because of the limited parking, and the limited parks and state parks to facilitate all these visitors.
Now, is this a state road or a county road?
The highway is a state road. Some of the turnoffs to some of the highlight sites along the way are county roads, so we've got both county and state roads in play here.
Does that create problems, just the fact that there are two different jurisdictions you have to talk to?
Yes, definitely. So in regards to some of the restroom facilities, you know, it'll fall under the county. Some of them fall under the state. So there's a lot of entities at the table here trying to figure things out.
Well, what's your entity doing?
So I'm a board member with the Hana Community Association, and we've adopted the Hana Highway Regulation, which is an initiative that I started last year to implement some measures to increase the safety and efficiency of the road to Hana.
Mm-hmm. Which are?
First of all, we've got our code of conduct, which we published in June, and that's sort of a general guideline. There's never been a formalized set of rules for driving the Hana Highway. Everybody has their suggestions, but there's never been one list of rules that everybody can turn to and sort of refer to how to do it the right way. So we published the Code of Conduct in early summer and have been editing it since then. Some community associations from the North Shore have put in, you know, new line items, and so it's constantly an edit. But that's sort of our baseline core where we are starting from as far as just putting out a set of rules for the road to Hana.
Well, the rules don't have the force of law, right? They're a code of conduct that you hope people will follow, yeah?
Yes, they're a suggested list of rules.
What kind of things, give me a hint. What are some of the things that you're asking?
Sure. So some of the preliminary rules are really state the obvious types of things. Check your vehicle, make sure you've got all the right fluids, make sure you've got gas, check weather conditions. And then it gets a little bit more in-depth as far as traversing the road to Hana, where we suggest you visit, state parks, county parks, established venues that invite visitors to come and experience their property and whatnot. Trying to encourage people to stay away from private properties and areas of danger. And then it gets a little bit more thorough as far as the sunscreen issue and using reef-safe sunscreen and trying not to displace soil and rocks, and gets in detail towards the end.
What about road conditions?
Always suggesting visitors check on road conditions before heading out. There's landslides at any point in time, so just staying up to date with the news as far as, you know, if there's any tree down, if there are any trees down, or if there are any weather conditions that would prohibit access to Hana.
One of the ideas that's been suggested in Apua is charging a toll for drivers who do not have a Hawaii State driver's license. Those people would get no charge. What do you think of that idea?
That idea has been tossed around for quite some time now by residences. We understand that that'll be a little bit future tense as far as creating a system where we could maybe manage reservations or entry fees for the road to Hana. But for the time being, we're just starting with our code of conduct. We're implementing a commercial operator program here shortly for anybody who does commercial activity in the scope of the road to Hana. We feel that that will really help us get a handle on some of the private property trespassing issues we have. And then our third objective is to implement a community patrol, which would help enforce the regulations that the Department of Transportation, Public Utilities Commission, and Department of Health have trouble upholding because of their lack in staffing. So we feel that these three short-term objectives will help manage the situation for the time being until we can put more thought and effort into planning for potentially a road toll or access fee for visitors.
The whole idea of an access fee for visitors creates a little bit of a division between visitors and locals, doesn't it?
Definitely. Nature, we expect it to sort of be free to enjoy. But at this point, there's been a lot of tension between residents and visitors with the situation of residents needing the road for, you know, medical visits on the other side of the island and whatnot. So we've been kind of weighing the priority of needs as far as residents to visitors go.
If there's tension already between visitors and locals, it's not likely to diminish if you charge visitors a toll and don't charge locals, right?
Right. I don't see much of that.
You don't see much of what? I'm sorry.
Oh, I don't see much tension as far as the residents to the visitors.
I thought you just said something to that effect. But it does seem as if the interests of visitors and residents don't always intersect, yeah?
Right. It's quite a big issue here we're dealing with. We have, you know, numerous different industries in play here. So we've been trying to gather community and commercial insight over the course of this first year so we can really figure out where we go from here, because there's, like I said, numerous entities in the work.
I would think that those entities would have some very different interests. Some of them want to encourage, I would think, as many visitors as they can.
Right. So very tough to balance all of the interests, but we're doing our best to get the full scope of perspective, and then we will work on the solutionary after that.
Well, it's a lot of balancing to be done, Napua, but I wish you luck. Thanks very much for talking with us.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate the time.
You bet. Napuahueo is a resident of Kainai, a small town along the road to Hana, located in the Ko'olamoku. Her family has raised taro here for generations, managed its fruit stand for more than 30 years. In 2017, the Hana Community Association voted her in as a board member and adopted her entity as an initiative of the organization. The entity is called the Hana Highway Regulation. You can learn more about it on our Facebook page, The Conversation.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the National Kidney Foundation of Hawaii, whose Kidney Cars program provides funding for community health and education services. Learn more about vehicle donation at kidneyhi.org.
Biofuels may well be the fuel source of the future, and new sources of biofuel are still being found. Pongamia is a little-known crop with a lot of potential. It's being cultivated on 50 acres of former sugarcane land on Oahu's North Shore, and Civil Beach Stuart Yurton is on the line to tell us what it can do. Good morning, Stuart.
Good morning, Chris.
Had you ever heard of this stuff before you got onto this story?
I had not heard of Pongamia.
Me neither.
but it sounds pretty interesting what they're doing with it here.
Well, it sounds as if there are a number of uses, but what is it? It's a bean plant? It's a small tree?
Yes, they say it's a leguminous tree, and so it grows these beans. And actually, the ones that are planted on the North Shore are not so big. They're maybe about 5 to 7 feet tall now. But if you across the street from the law school, where you pull in to go down the hill to the stadium there on the UH campus, there's
right.
a tree next to Bachman Hall. It's giant. It must be 100 years old, and it's very big. So
really?
They can get really big, apparently.
And this has beans that have oil in them, right?
Right. Yes, exactly. So the idea is the beans are very rich in oil, so they can produce a lot of oil for biofuel. Plus, this company called Terviva has come up with a way to press the used beans after they've been pressed to get the oil out, to take that other product and turn them into feed for cattle, for beef cattle.
Uh-huh.
And then they can use the shell or the husks of the beans for biomass to burn for power generators. So you've got three products out of this, and that kind of, by doing all of that, makes it cost effective to refine this for fuel, right? Because you've got other things that they're doing and not just saying, okay, we got one bean and we've got to figure out a way to do this and make it competitive with jet fuel or something like that.
Yeah, that's remarkable. The potential is terrific. One of the things I think that's significant about this, Stuart, is that it can be grown on former sugarcane land, because that's not the most hospitable ag land. After sugarcane is gone, the land isn't worth that much, is my understanding.
That's what I understand. Plus, it doesn't require a lot of water. They're still trying to figure out how little water it needs. But he said the Terviva manager, the local manager here, Will Cush, that we spoke to, is a plant scientist, and he said that it requires an order of magnitude less water than sugar. So that's important here in Hawaii, obviously.
Well, it also makes you wonder how many more biofuels are out there that we haven't even explored yet, because really the whole idea of even thinking about biofuels is fairly recent.
That's right, Chris. And again, we'll have to think of this a lot more moving forward to 2045, when we want to have 100% of our electricity produced by renewable resources. So this could be one big component of that.
Well, it certainly is a step in the right direction, Stuart. Thanks very much for telling us about it.
Thank you, Chris.
You bet. Every day we bring you a reality check from Civil Beat, today featuring reporter Stuart Yurton. Maui is the home of one of the country's most honored poets, W.S. Merwin, former U.S. Poet Laureate and Pulitzer Prize winner. The occasion of his 90th birthday has brought another much-honored poet, Edward Hirsch, to Hawaii for a tribute event this weekend as part of the Merwin Conservancy's practice of bringing some of Merwin's kindred spirits to the island. Edward Hirsch is with us in our studio. And thanks very much for being here.
Thanks, my great pleasure.
It's a great pleasure to have you here.
Thanks, Chris.
We were talking earlier about, I was just telling you an anecdote a few minutes ago about a friend of mine in the news media who basically said, I have no use for poetry, and kind of challenged me to make a case for poetry as part of our lives. How would you have responded to that particular challenge?
I would say that, first I'd say there's never been a culture without poetry in the history of the world. Mm-hmm. So that suggests that it's not just that there's some, you know, freaky avant-garde people who like it. It means that poetry carries some kind of information that you can't get from the news, actually. You get it somewhere else. Mm-hmm. I would say it speaks to our affective lives, your inner life, mm-hmm. the overflow of feeling that you have, the record of not what it was exactly like, but what it felt like mm-hmm. through language. It's the art of language, which is one of the highest human achievements. So I would say that, you know, if you not just in moments of great stress, but certainly when people suffer deaths, when their children are born, when they get married, people turn in ritual occasions to poetry. And the mm-hmm. reason for that is because they need something to articulate the overflow of feeling that they have. Mm-hmm. And they turn to lyric poetry to tell that story.
And when you hear it, you know it when you hear it, right?
Absolutely. It's the same reason that people turn to song. Mm-hmm. There's something elevated in it in terms of the way we feel.
I often feel that a poem on the page is only part of the experience, that it would have been ideal to have heard Yeats read The Second Coming or to hear you or Merwin or any poet read his work.
It's kind of a score.
That's a very good analogy.
It's kind of a score. Now, the interesting thing about reading poetry is that when you read a poem, not just when you hear Yeats read, but when you read a Yeats poem aloud, you are the vehicle of that poem. Mm-hmm. Your voice, your vocal cords, your body. That's not true in music, for example. But it's not true when you play a sonata mm-hmm. by mm-hmm. Mozart. But when you read a poem, you are taking it into your own body, and mm-hmm. your own breath gives it life. I will say, though, that there is something to be said for reading as well as reciting poems aloud, because reading enables you to pause, to see something that you didn't see before, to reread.
Yeah.
So that's the difference between, say, the Homeric epics, which were oral, and, say, reading Sappho. So when Sappho takes two words like bittersweet, and she takes bitter and she puts sweet together, mm-hmm. two different words. And she says, eros, the bittersweet, love, the bittersweet. She identifies a feeling that we recognize now, but no one had named before. And giving you time to read it on the page, you go, well, what does that mean?
Yeah. Actually, and the fact that it also says it in a very few words.
Well, that's poetry.
The bittersweet, four words with that continue to resonate every time you say them.
Epic poems are the sort of the tale of the tribe. Lyric poems are the stories of individuals. And the art of lyric poetry is the art of condensation. Mm-hmm. And one of the things about poetry that's very interesting and moving, I think, is that the way in which the thing is said is inseparable from what is being said. That is, it carries its own meaning. Mm-hmm. The Russian poet Osip Mandelstam said, if a poem can be paraphrased, then the sheets haven't been rumpled. Poetry hasn't spent the night.
That's pretty good.
I like it too.
Well, you also can a poem be translated?
The answer is yes and no.
Yeah.
You can never get an exact equivalent for the poem, but translation is also crucial.
Yeah.
Because there are poems in other languages that just you don't get that sensibility, that feeling.
Yeah.
And speaking of W.S. Merwin, he's been one of the greatest translators of our time.
He
spent much of his life translating poetry.
Yeah. And you have to be a poet yourself to translate a poem, I would imagine.
Well, I think the trouble with translating poetry is that literal translations don't work. Mm-hmm. And the reason you need a poet to translate, you also need someone who knows the language. But the reason a poet does it is because you need something equivalent in your own language mm-hmm. to make it work. And it's absolutely crucial for Western civilization that we read the Greek poems, for example, even if we don't know Greek.
Yeah.
And so every culture has a literature, and so we need translation to make that literature available to us.
Well, as soon as I raised the idea that it would be difficult to translate a poem, I thought of, you know, where would we be without the translations of Homer, which yield itself to infinite number of translations.
Exactly, or Horace, or Catullus, mm-hmm. or Sappho, mm-hmm. Or the great Russians. I mean, it's just crucial to the endeavor of building a civilization. I like something that Mandelstam said about a movement called Acmeism, which he called a nostalgia for world culture. And I have that nostalgia, and I think translation is crucial to it.
Yeah, yeah. Talking about W.S. Merwin as a longtime resident of Hawaii and as someone who's very much bonded with the life of Hawaii as a, you know, raising palm trees on his property, what kind of effect has his work, knowing him, had on you and your work?
I'd say the main thing is his moral example. Mm-hmm. The poetry was never a career for him. It was always a vocation. It was always a calling. And he always saw poetry not just as a series of literary games, but as part of something for the completeness of life, for the completion of life. And for me, the model, the resolute model of working everything out in poetry, of thinking through poetry, and moving from a kind of despair that he felt about the world in the 1960s mm-hmm. to trying to do something about it. He came here in 77 mm-hmm. and began to tend the land and learn how to tend the land. So the example, the moral rectitude of it and the giving of his life to it, and not just to his own poetry, but both to the land and to the poetry of others for his translations, that's been a tremendous model for me.
Each of his messages on email says, on the last day of the world, I would plant a tree.
Yes, that's the messages from the Merwin Conservancy.
Yeah.
Merwin himself doesn't use email. But yes, exactly. I brought that poem Place, by the way, that has that line.
Uh-huh. Well, please read it, yeah.
This is called Place. On the last day of the world, I would want to plant a tree. What for? Not for the fruit. The tree that bears the fruit is not the one that was planted. I want the tree that stands in the earth for the first time, with the sun already going down, and the water touching its roots, and the earth full of the dead, and the clouds passing, one by one, over its leaves.
That's lovely, and as you were reading it, I thought of how so many people are likely to say, and I know you've heard this a million times when you talk about poetry, I don't know much about it. And as I heard that, I thought, I don't have to know anything.
Exactly. You might not know a lot about poetry, but you can just start where you are. And that's what I would say to what's there to know, exactly.
Yeah.
You start wherever you are. Poetry is an experience, and I wouldn't concentrate too much on overinterpreting it. The more you're interested in poetry, the more you'll want to learn about it.
Yeah.
But I think you just start where it is. And a poem like that, which has its mysteries but also its clarities, I think you can get it. You hear something right on the first time you hear it.
You get the clarities the first time around.
Absolutely.
And then as you reread, the mysteries come home to you.
They continue to deepen, exactly.
Which is also, that moves us toward a definition of poetry, doesn't it? You know,
I think so. You have some kind of immediate experience. Emily Dickinson said when she read a book, she felt as if the top of her head were coming off. You have some kind of immediate experience.
Uh-huh.
And then the more you look at it, the more you see.
That's a really good. That's a really good way to look at it. And are you encouraged that people coming up, you know, young people today are responding to poetry? That they're going to be keeping it alive, creating new works, taking new directions.
It's a kind of a relief. Since there's never been a culture without poetry, I don't want us to be the ones who drop the ball.
If anybody could, it would be ours.
Yes, exactly. So we need to keep something alive. But you know, I think there will always be, you know, it can't just all be buying things all the time. It just can't be consumer culture.
Yeah.
It just can't be 24-hour news channels all the time. We need space for our interior lives. And poetry gives us that space the way religion does. But I'd say the difference between religion and poetry is that poetry is a kind of unauthorized testimony. It's the testimony of an individual without the creed of a church.
Uh-huh.
But it's someone saying, this is what it felt like to live here. This is what it was like for me.
That really puts it so well, Ed. Thank you so much for talking with us.
My great pleasure. Thank you.
Edward Hirsch will take part in a tribute to W.S. Merwin this Friday at 7 p.m. at the McCoy Studio Theater at the Maui Arts and Cultural Center. And now we're going to return you to Pledge Central.